All right, before we begin, let's address this off the top. You're skeptical, and you should be. You've seen titles like this before, Science Proves the Afterlife, and every time it turns out to be some pseudoscience babble or a religious argument dressed up in lab coat language. So of course you're already bracing for that. You're thinking, all right, here we go. He's about to quote some scripture, slide into the Bible or the Quran halfway through. But actually, no. This week's episode is not that. Not even close. We will not mention religious texts or holy books once today. Not Christianity, not Islam, not Buddhism, not any of them. What you're about to listen to has taken 8 years to make. 8 years of personal study within Mighty Pursuit and reading across disciplines that almost never talk to each other. There are 11 separate scientific fields we're going to walk through today. Collectively, they span 134 years of research. And we're living at a unique moment in time where all these fields have advanced enough to even have this conversation. Inside each of these fields, there are serious scientists who have discovered things that are, well, difficult to ignore. Some of them have connected pieces of the puzzle, but to our knowledge, no one has stepped back and laid it all out in one straight line. In fact, we actually did try to find a guest for this episode, but what we realized is that no single expert holds the full picture. So that is why this episode is probably unique from anything you've ever probably seen. You're not getting one perspective, you're getting the synthesis. And then at the end, we're going to talk about what it all means, because it has massive implications for your life. All right, so the only proper starting point for this conversation is to get our definition straight, because the words science, proof, and afterlife don't land neutrally. They land loaded. The second you hear them, your brain starts filling in the blanks. And this is just how cognition works. Daniel Kahneman, who won a Nobel Prize for his work on decision-making, showed that our brains are constantly running fast, automatic pattern recognition before we're even aware of it. You don't encounter words objectively. You encounter them through associations. And here's a simple example. Let's just say I put three images on the screen, a pride flag, a red Trump hat, and a Black Lives Matter poster. And I didn't even say a single word. You would already feel something. You'd already have assumptions about me, about what I believe, about where this is going, all before a single argument was even made. That's how fast the brain works. And the same thing happens when you hear science, proof, afterlife. Those words don't show up empty. They show up carrying stereotypes, carrying past debates, carrying YouTube clickbait, carrying religion, atheism, culture wars. So before we go any further, we need to get clear on this. Because if we don't define what we mean, you'll be arguing with a version of this episode that doesn't actually exist. So let's define something carefully. When we say science, we mean the method, not the word stamped on a headline. Science is a process. It's observation, then it's forming a hypothesis, then it's testing that hypothesis, then it's trying to break your own idea, and then finally letting other people try to break it too. Over and over again until something survives. And when an idea survives enough pressure, that's when we start to use a word like proof. Because independent groups in different places across time keep finding the same pattern again and again and again. That's what proof means in science. In essence, it's the highest level of confidence we can reach through repeated testing. When different methods, different labs, different decades all keep pointing in the same direction, eventually we treat that conclusion as settled, or really as much as it possibly could be. Now, compare that to how the word proof gets used today. You'll see a headline that says, "This one workout erases cancer." And then you look closer and you discover it's a study of 12 mice. It's never been replicated, and suddenly we're supposed to rewrite reality around it. That's not proof. That's a study. A single study is a data point. Proof is what happens when evidence reaches a level of convergence where denying it becomes irrational. So when I use the word proof in this episode, that's what I mean. Not a viral paper or a flashy headline, but convergence across fields, decades, and methods. Now, there's one more word we need to define: afterlife. Because that word is also loaded. For some people, it means heaven. For others, it means mythology. For others, it just means wishful thinking. But when we use the word afterlife here, we're talking about something very specific. The possibility that consciousness isn't created by the brain, but filters through it. And if that's true, then death wouldn't be the end of our awareness. It would be a transition. And if awareness continues, then we have to ask, what kind of reality does it continue into? And who or what might we encounter there? That's the claim on the table, and it's a big one. So how do you test a claim that big? You don't start with feelings. You don't start with belief. You start with the hardest kind of data you can find, what we're going to call Tier 1A in this episode. These are the only domains we found where the non-material dimension crosses into the shared physical world in ways that can be independently verified. And within Tier 1A, there are three separate areas of research that have grown too large to dismiss. Different institutions, different experts, different contexts, but they keep arriving at the same pressure point, which is ultimately that materialism, the notion that the physical world is all there is not the full picture of reality. So the first field we need to look at is near-death studies. Now, the seeds of this field go all the way back to 1892 with a Swiss geologist named Albert Heim. It all started because doctors started noticing a strange pattern. Patients who had clinically died and no detectable heartbeat, flatline monitors, somehow came back to life. And when they did, they started describing what happened while they were dead. In 1975, a psychiatrist named Raymond Moody began systematically interviewing these survivors. And what he found launched an entire field. 51 years later, tens of thousands of cases have been rigorously documented. Near-death experiences now hold one of the most extensive data sets in modern consciousness research. And that doesn't even account for the millions of people who never entered a study, whose experiences were never formally recorded but followed the same patterns. Most recently, actor Jeremy Renner publicly described his own near-death experience, echoing many of the same elements we're about to examine. So what exactly were these people experiencing while they were dead? It starts with the most significant discovery across the 11 fields we'll discuss today, vertical perception. Now imagine this, a man is in cardiac arrest. He's on a hospital table, doctors are working on him, voices are shouting, monitors are flatlining, and at some point he loses consciousness. Later, after he's resuscitated, he starts describing something strange. He says he wasn't just on the table, he says he was above it, looking down. He describes a nurse standing near the doorway, he repeats a specific sentence one of the doctors said, he mentions a piece of equipment that was brought into the room, and then he says something even stranger. He says his mother was down the hallway at a vending machine and accidentally dropped her phone. And when the staff later spoke to the mother, that's exactly what she said happened. So in simple terms, vertical perception means this. One, the person reports leaving their body. Two, they describe specific physical events. And three, those events are later independently confirmed. Now, the immediate response to this is obvious. So hallucination, memory distortion. He must have heard something before he went under. The doctors must have unintentionally fed him details later. And those are all fair observations and conclusions. But here's where it gets uncomfortable. Many of the cases don't involve details inside the room. They involve events outside the room, like in our example, down the hallway, in other parts of the hospital, even outside the building. Details that were later confirmed by people who had no relationship to the patient. People who were surprised when the account was even brought up. In some documented cases, the third-party witness didn't even know the patient had reported anything until they were interviewed separately. And this is where this moves from an interesting observation to impossible to explain under the assumption that the physical world is all there is. Because now we're not talking about overheard words. We're talking about spatial awareness that crosses physical boundaries. Your brain is literally incapable of doing that. Meaning, if you're in a room with four walls, it would be impossible that you would be able to see what's happening outside of it, not under the assumption that the physical world is all there is. Now look at the scale. Across multiple large data sets, the majority of people who report a near-death experience say they left their body. In a systematic review by Dr. Jeffrey Long of over 1,300 NDE accounts, roughly 75% of people reported an out-of-body experience. In clinical samples reviewed by Dr. Bruce Grayson, that number is often at 80%. And when researchers examine the subset of cases with checkable details of what people reported while they were outside their body, Dr. Jen Holden found that 92% were categorized as completely accurate by independent witnesses. This is remarkable. The level of detail in these accounts is often higher than normal waking memory. Think about it. If you walked into a hospital room right now during a chaotic emergency, you probably couldn't later repeat exact phrases, specific movements, the order of events, the precise placement of equipment with that kind of clarity. And yet these patients describe events during cardiac arrest with striking precision, which leads to the second feature of near-death experiences, that people consistently describe their awareness not as fading, but as intensifying, sharper, clearer, as they call it, more real than real. And from there, their consciousness doesn't dissolve into chaos. It transitions into a highly structured dimension. Across cultures, decades, and belief systems, the same core elements of post-death experience keep appearing. Vertical perception and heightened awareness are just two of them. Now, not every person reports every detail, but the architecture is remarkably stable. And once you see that pattern in full, it becomes very difficult to dismiss. As they start to transition, the third feature is moving through something like a tunnel. Now, this isn't always literal, but it does feel like a narrowing, a passage, and a shift into another world. Then comes what may be the most unsettling part, a life review. Not one full of judgment and condemnation, but sort of like a panoramic reliving of their life. From their perspective and from the perspective of the people they affected. They don't just remember what they did, they remember what others felt. Then, almost universally, there is an encounter with a higher presence. Now, people use different names for it, God, Source, the Being of Light, but the description is strikingly consistent, an overwhelming presence, intelligent, personal, and defined by one core characteristic, unconditional love. Then they describe entering another realm, beautiful beyond language, so beautiful that most say the same thing. They didn't want to come back. In that realm, they are often met by people that they know, deceased family members, friends with recognizable identities, and sometimes there are also beings. And throughout all this, time behaves differently. Not linear or ticking forward, but expansive. And their sense of self changes too. They often describe having a body, but not quite like our physical one. A body made of awareness, and words happen without words. Direct, immediate, in essence, telepathic, thought to thought. But not every experience is positive. A smaller percentage describes something very different. They enter a dark realm, a realm that feels empty or heavy. And here's what's striking. In many of these accounts, when the person calls out to something beyond themselves, the experience shifts. They describe being pulled upward and out of it and towards the same presence of overwhelming love others encounter from the beginning. Which makes this pattern even more interesting, because the polarity of the two places still operate within the same architecture. And almost universally, people feel a sense that there is a boundary, maybe a line or a gate or a river or a threshold. They use different imagery, but it's the same function. They understand clearly that if they cross the boundary, they will not return to the physical world. Some are even told explicitly, it's not your time. Others simply know. There is a point of no return, and they are brought back to this physical world before crossing it. Now, let's pause for a second, because that is a lot. And if you're feeling something right now, curiosity, resistance, discomfort, that's normal. Remember, Daniel Kahneman showed that the brain is an associative machine. So this entire time, when you hear words like light, judgment, presence, realm, all of this stuff, your mind pulls up everything it's ever heard about religion, heaven, hell, church debates, doctrine. But as we said from the beginning, this isn't a conversation about religion. It's an analysis of experiences collected and studied in clinical settings. It's researchers documenting what people consistently describe. And one of the first objections is always this. People just see what they expect to see. But that explanation doesn't make much sense when you consider the structure of the experience is the same across cultures and belief systems. Atheists report the same loving presence. Christians sometimes report distressing realms. And this is where the pattern becomes important. Because think about what we're looking at. Tens of thousands of reports, across countries, across belief systems, medically documented across 134 years, and yet the core structure remains remarkably similar. In many areas of science, we don't discover something is real because we trapped it in a lab. We discover it's real because the same pattern keeps showing up in geology, in cosmology, in epidemiology. And when that same architecture appears again and again, at some point, coincidence becomes implausible. Now, even if someone accepts the structure of the experience, the next objection is predictable. It's just a dying brain, right? But that explanation runs into two serious problems. First, hallucinations are typically chaotic. They vary widely from person to person, but near-death experiences don't. They're structured and remarkably consistent. That's not what random neural misfiring looks like. Second, hallucinations don't typically produce enhanced cognition. They degrade awareness and distort it. And once you add in vertical perception, the dying brain theory crumbles. Because if someone accurately described events that happened outside their spatial awareness and their consciousness broke through the barriers of the four walls that surrounded them, then awareness was not confined to their brain. And this is where the conversation around the brain actually starts to lose all its relevance. You can think about it this way. So if a friend tells you they visited New York City and they accurately describe a specific obscure alleyway you know, you don't suddenly doubt when they describe a part of the city you don't know. You trust their description because they've already demonstrated reliability. So in near-death cases, that part of the city you know is the third party who confirms what happened in the room. That what someone described is accurate and truthful. And in some cases, the verification doesn't stop with what happened in the room. It extends further into what they claim happened in that other place. For example, let's just say they encountered someone in that other dimension during their experience, someone they believed was still alive. Then they come back and tell their family who they saw. And only then do they learn that that person had died, sometimes recently, sometimes that same day. There are many documented cases in the literature where this kind of information is later independently verified. And that matters for a simple reason. If someone accurately reports information they had no normal way of accessing, then the explanation cannot be limited to imagination. At that point, you're not dealing with symbolism, you're dealing with data. And once data crosses that line, the question actually changes. It's no longer, did they have some sort of experience? It becomes, how did they acquire that information? Because if we can acquire information independent of normal sensory input, then the brain is not the sole producer of consciousness. And that shifts our entire model of reality. And here's the part that is stunning. That's just one field, one. And what we began to notice over the last 8 years is that what it reveals doesn't stand alone. The same structure keeps appearing in completely independent fields of research. And that leads us to our second field. Hospice care. Now, the roots of this field also go back over 100 years. An Irish physicist named William Barrett began collecting reports of people who, shortly before death, claimed to see deceased friends and relatives. At the time, those were dismissed as anecdotes. In the mid-20th century, psychologists Carlos Osis and Arlinder Haraldsson began systematically studying reports from doctors and nurses who worked with the dying. They surveyed thousands of physicians and nurses who collectively observed tens of thousands of deaths across multiple countries. And they found the same consistent pattern as Barrett with a much larger data set, which is that in the final weeks before death, many patients reported seeing people who had already died. Not strangers or random figures, but specific relatives with recognizable identities. This became known as deathbed visions. And just like near-death experiences, they follow a very specific structure. So consistent, in fact, that hospice workers are now trained to recognize it as a standard part of the dying process. It's in onboarding materials for hospice workers. Now, the immediate reaction to this is predictable. Okay, hallucinations, delirium, end-of-life confusion, let's move on. And of course, at first glance, that sounds reasonable. But when you actually sit with the data, a much stranger story starts to emerge. These experiences don't happen randomly. They start about 3 weeks before death, almost on a clock. It's then that the majority of patients start having visions. People begin reporting seeing people in the room. They'll say things like, "My mother is here," or "Dad came to get me," or simply, "They're waiting." And what's most striking is what those relatives are described as doing. They're preparing and reassuring the patient for a transition, telling them it's almost time, telling them they're not alone. And as death approaches, the experiences often intensify. Some hospice workers describe what's called the death stare. A patient suddenly fixates at a point in the room, a point that no one else sees, and their expression changes. Sometimes they smile, sometimes they whisper, "I see them," or "It's beautiful." There are even well-known accounts like Steve Jobs' final words reported as, "Oh wow, oh wow, oh wow," all while looking to a fixed point in the room. And many nurses report another common part of the experience. Patients often seem to choose their moment to die. They hold on until a loved one arrives, or they wait until someone steps out of the room. They say, "I'm going home." And then shortly after, they pass. Now, to understand why this doesn't fit the category of hallucination or delirium, you have to understand how those actually work. Hallucinations are usually fragmented, disorganized, rapidly shifting, often frightening and paranoid. They don't involve calm, structured conversations with specific deceased relatives. And any nurse who has worked in trauma units or ICUs can describe end-of-life delirium, confusion, agitation, disorientation, speech that doesn't quite track. Deathbed visions are different. They are coherent. Patients remain often oriented. They know where they are. They know who is in the room. And some even say, "I know this sounds strange, but my mother is standing right there." They recognize how unusual it is. They describe it clearly, and yet at the same time, they describe the experience as, wait for it, more real than real. The same words used by people who have near-death experiences. They don't feel fragmented or dreamlike. They're overwhelmingly peaceful and comforting, as if the fear of death has been removed entirely. And like near-death experiences, this isn't limited to the religious. It happens to atheists, skeptics, and people who never believed in anything beyond the physical world. And whether this is actually happening is tested by two surrounding facts. One, researchers have looked at the difference between visions of living people and deceased relatives. And overwhelmingly, these reports involve people who have already died. In some studies, over 80 to 90% of reported figures were dead relatives. And that matters, because if this was simply the brain misfiring, you expect a random mix. Anyone the mind has stored, living or dead, but that's not what shows up. And interestingly, when patients do report seeing living people, those episodes are far more likely to be confused, fragmented, or distressing. The calm, structured, reassuring encounters overwhelmingly involve the deceased. So that's the first tension point, who they see. Now, the second is separate from the visions themselves. It's not about what dying patients report seeing. It's about what happens to their brains. Hospice workers call it the rally or terminal lucidity. So picture someone with advanced dementia, maybe severe Alzheimer's, a person who hasn't recognized their own children in years. And then suddenly, sometimes hours or days before death, clarity returns. They remember the past. They recognize people. They start to speak coherently and express love. And shortly after, they die. Now, think about what that implies. If the brain is a sole producer of consciousness and the brain is severely damaged, where is that clarity coming from? Now, let's step back once again and consider what we've observed. In near-death experiences, people describe encountering a structured realm. They encounter deceased relatives and describe it as more real than real. They overwhelmingly report peace and feel like they are home. So much so, there is a reluctance to return to this physical world. Now look at hospice. Weeks before death, patients begin seeing deceased relatives. The experiences are also structured, relational, and peaceful, more real than real. And they often say they're going home. It's a different context, but it's the same pattern. Near-death experiences suggest that the boundary between the physical world and something beyond it can rupture. Hospice data suggests that as death approaches, that same boundary begins to thin. And that raises a new question. If that boundary is real, can it be crossed from the other side? Because there's a third field where something appears to push against it. And it doesn't begin in a hospital. It begins in the sky. And this is where it gets really interesting. UFOs. were what they're now officially called unidentified aerial phenomena. All right, so I know you didn't expect that turn. For some of you, that word alone just triggered a reaction. Kahneman strikes again. But UFOs are controversial. They're polarizing, and including them in a serious conversation about consciousness and reality feels, well, strange. And I'll be honest, for years we resisted this topic. It felt fringe and sensational, like something serious people didn't touch. But when we started pulling on threads across independent fields, we concluded that we couldn't just ignore one because it makes us feel uncomfortable. We followed the data, and we're inviting you to do the same. So here's what is not debated anymore. The U.S. government has publicly acknowledged that unidentified aerial phenomena exist. They have been formally studying UFOs in its airspace since at least 1947. Project Blue Book alone collected 12,618 reports. Of those, 701 were classified as unidentified. That's not a conspiracy. It's public record. And in 2017, reporting by Leslie Keene and Ralph Lumenthal in the New York Times revealed that the Pentagon had been continuing classified UAP investigations despite public claims that programs had ended decades earlier. Since then, the Department of Defense has released multiple confirmed UAP videos. Congress now receives annual reports. And between 2023 and 2024 alone, hundreds of new cases were logged, and dozens remain officially unexplained. So this isn't about whether unidentified aerial phenomena exist. They do. The question is what they are. And what makes them relevant here is not just their mystery. It's their behavior. Investigators have described what is often called the five observables of UAPs. First, extreme acceleration. They go from stationary to thousands of miles per hour almost instantly. If a human pilot tried to do that, the force would crush them. Second, instantaneous direction changes. Picture an aircraft traveling at 10,000 miles per hour. Now imagine it stopping on a dime and turning 90 degrees in a fraction of a second. If a human pilot were inside that craft, the acceleration would generate forces strong enough to liquefy internal organs. Fighter pilots black out at around 9 Gs. These maneuvers will require forces many times beyond that. And yet these objects don't shatter or disintegrate. Third, they go at extreme speeds without the signs that speed normally produces. So when a jet breaks the sound barrier, you hear it, that sonic boom. When a rocket accelerates, you see flames and exhaust. So high speed leaves evidence because energy has to come from somewhere. But in many of these cases, pilots report objects moving at extraordinary speeds without visible engines, without exhaust, without the kind of heat signature you would expect from propulsion. Nothing seems to be pushing against them. The fourth is that they move between air and water. Now think about that for a second. If you throw a rock into the water, it splashes and slows down. If a plane hit the ocean at high speed, it would break apart because water isn't air. It resists you. And yet these objects are reported dropping from the sky, hitting the ocean, and just continuing. No explosion, no slowing, no debris, as if the water wasn't even there. And then there's the fifth observable, disappearance. These objects are tracked clearly on the radar, seen by trained pilots, and then suddenly, poof, they're gone. No visible turn, no drop in altitude, no gradual loss of signal, gone like they were never there to begin with. And in aviation, things don't simply vanish without leaving some kind of trace. So when you stack all five of those behaviors together, you get something that is extraordinarily difficult to account for. These movements don't align with how objects are supposed to behave under modern physics. Now, there are explanations offered. Advanced human technologies, sensor glitches, radar spoofing, optical illusions, foreign adversary craft. And those are reasonable explanations at first. But when you examine the full pattern, each explanation begins to crumble. If it's radar error, that doesn't explain simultaneous visual confirmation by trained military pilots. If it's optical illusion, that doesn't explain multi-sensor tracking, radar, infrared, and human eyes all at once. But the most implausible explanation may be that this is secret human or foreign adversary technology. Take the 2004 Nimitz Tic Tac encounter. radar operators tracked an object descending from extremely high altitude to near sea level in seconds. Pilots visually confirmed it. Analysts later estimated speeds that would place it 10 times faster than the fastest aircraft ever built. For context, the SR-71 Blackbird, the fastest operational manned aircraft in history, tops out at about Mach 3. Now go back to 1947 when Project Blue Book began, one of the original government programs studying UFOs. Breaking the bound barriers had just happened, and Mach 1 was revolutionary. Yet unexplained objects were already being reported performing maneuvers far beyond what aircraft of that era could achieve. If these are secret human craft, then someone achieved aerospace capabilities decades, perhaps even centuries, ahead of publicly known science, and kept them hidden for at least 80 years. We mentioned earlier we were uncomfortable with this topic, but at what point does the conservative and rational explanation become the most extraordinary claim of all? And this is where a simple analogy from pop culture could help. In the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Thor moves through our world in ways that look like magic. He flies without engines, he accelerates instantly, he absorbs energy, he moves as if inertia doesn't apply to him. From our perspective, that violates physics. But in that story, Thor isn't breaking the laws of reality. He's operating under a different framework, one that we don't share. Now, UFOs are obviously not Thor, but it helps us understand that if something originates from a dimension with different constraints, it would look impossible to us. And here's where this becomes even more interesting, because the physical behavior is only half the story. When people report close encounters with these phenomena, they don't just describe objects. They describe an interaction. And that's where more serious academics have stepped in. In the 1990s, Harvard psychiatrist John Mack began studying these experiences up close. Now, he wasn't a fringe figure. He was a Pulitzer Prize-winning psychiatrist, chair of the psychiatry department at Harvard Medical School. His decision to investigate these cases was controversial. He was publicly criticized and professionally scrutinized. But instead of dismissing these accounts outright, he did something simple and unprecedented at that level. He actually sat down with people and listened to them in depth. And what he found complicated the narrative. Some of the experiences were terrifying. Others were profound and transformative. Many described encounters with intelligences, beings, if you want to call them that, and communication that did not rely on spoken language. Instead, they spoke of direct exchanges of meaning, what they'd often described as telepathic communication, sudden overwhelming downloads of information, a sense that reality was far larger than they had previously assumed. If that sounds familiar, it should, because structurally what Mack documented has parallels to what we've already seen in near-death research. There are positive encounters and negative encounters. There are reports of otherworldly beings. There is nonverbal telepathic communication. There is a radical alteration in how reality is perceived. And almost always there is lasting effects afterward. That parallel is hard to ignore. Now, the pushback to all of this is obvious. These people are mentally unwell, they're hallucinating, they're delusional, they're fantasy prone. And John Mack expected that too. He went into this assuming he would find pathology, schizophrenia, psychosis, unresolved trauma, some form of diagnosable instability that would explain these experiences away. Instead, what he reported was something different. The vast majority of individuals he studied were psychologically healthy. They were socially integrated. Many were successful in their careers. They did not meet the criteria for psychotic disorders. They were not detached from reality in the way schizophrenia or a clinical delusion would require. That didn't mean their experiences were easy to explain, but it did mean the simplest explanation, that they were mentally unstable, did not hold up under clinical examination. And that complicated the dismissal. Most recently, a new voice entered the conversation, Diana Walls-Pazuka, a professor at the University of North Carolina. Now, she did not enter the field as a believer in aliens or UFOs. She entered as a scholar, curious but careful, not trying to prove anything, not trying to debunk anything, simply trying to understand why so many highly educated, technically sophisticated people were reporting similar encounters. And over the past decade, she has become one of the most respected academic researchers studying UFOs. And what she documented was striking, nearly identical stories to Mac, and the same structural elements observed decades earlier. But she also discovered something else. Behind the public narrative, there exists a hidden network of highly credentialed scientists quietly studying this phenomenon. Which raises the ultimate question here. Who or what are these beings or crafts? For decades, the word alien shaped the conversation. And we're back to Kahneman. Words carry associations. When we say alien, we imagine a physical entity from another planet. But one of the leading theories among scientists studying this phenomenon is that UFOs are not extraterrestrial, or at least in the way we think they are, but rather they are interdimensional, meaning not from another planet, but from another layer of reality. One of the scientists Pazuka has written about is Gary Nolan, a Stanford professor of pathology, one of the most highly cited scientists in his field, an H index of over 130, which places him among the most influential biomedical scientists in the world. And in a public interview last year, Nolan stated that based on what he has seen, the phenomenon does not appear to be of conventional human origin. He used careful language, but ultimately he concluded, something non-human has been here a long time. Now let's step back once again and consider what Tier 1A just showed us. In NDEs, consciousness appears to cross a boundary. In hospice, that boundary appears to thin. And with UFOs, a boundary appears to be crossed from another side. Completely separate domains, all pointing to a dimension or dimensions outside the physical one. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't a million questions, and we'll get to them. But Tier 1A strongly suggests something difficult to ignore, that reality may not end at the physical world. And here's where it becomes even more interesting. If Tier 1A suggests there is something beyond the physical world, what we're labeling Tier 1B suggests we appear to be wired for it. Now, let's be precise about what that means. If human beings were meant to exist in a purely physical universe, you wouldn't expect transcendence to matter that much. You wouldn't expect it to shape our mental health or our resilience or our sense of meaning, but the data says it does. Our brains respond to transcendence. Our well-being improves when we orient towards something beyond ourselves. And some of our most profound psychological transformations occur through experiences people describe as spiritual. So much so, when we attempt to erase that dimension entirely, something in us deteriorates. And that brings us to our first field in Tier 1B, psychedelics. Now, depending on your worldview, that may feel dangerous, irresponsible, even outrageous. For decades, psychedelics were associated with illegal party culture and dismissed as nothing more than hallucinations. There was stigma and fear, and honestly, that shaped our entire perspective on the subject. In some ways, it made it even harder for us to examine the UFOs because the negative associations were so strong. But ultimately, we found ourselves in the same position we were with UFOs. We couldn't dismiss it because it made us uncomfortable. If the data was there, we had to look at it. And once you see it clearly, it's very hard to pretend you didn't. And to understand why this field matters, you have to understand its history. In the 1950s and 60s, researchers were already studying psychedelics in clinical settings. LSD, in particular, was being explored for depression, trauma, and addiction. Hundreds of papers were published, and early findings suggested significant therapeutic potential. Then the cultural explosion of the late 1960s happened, and the substances became associated with counterculture and political unrest. By the 1970s, psychedelics were classified as Schedule I substances, defined as having no accepted medical use. Research funding disappeared, studies halted, the field effectively went dormant for decades, not because the data had been disproven, but because the political climate had shifted. In the 1990s, a small group of researchers began cautiously reopening the door. Carefully designed studies, strict protocols, focus on safety. By the 2000s, institutions like Johns Hopkins and Imperial College London began conducting controlled trials again. And over the last decade, the research has accelerated dramatically. And what they found has been difficult to ignore. In clinical settings, under supervision, psychedelic experiences have been associated with significant reductions in depression, anxiety, addiction, and trauma symptoms, not in chaotic party environments, in labs, under medical supervision. And the most striking element isn't just symptom relief. It's what participants consistently describe happening during the experience. Now, it's important to be precise here because there are many psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin, DMT, MDMA. They don't all produce identical experiences. But across substances, researchers began noticing consistent features. Scientists developed something called the Mystical Experience Questionnaire, the MEQ, as a standardized way of measuring whether someone had what researchers call a mystical type experience. That includes things like ego dissolution, a temporary loss of the sense of being a separate self, a sense of sacredness, a feeling of deep unity or connection, transcendence of time and space. And here's where it gets interesting. The intensity of that mystical experience strongly predicts long-term outcomes. In other words, the deeper the sense of transcendence, the greater the sustained reduction in mental health symptoms. Now, what does that mean? One interpretation is simple. Psychedelics remove the filter or boundary that we've been discussing. Under this view, the brain isn't generating a hallucination. It's reducing its normal constraints, temporarily loosening whatever keeps perception confined to the physical world, allowing people to access or at least glimpse to something beyond it. That's a theory. We don't yet have the tools to prove that's what's happening, and that is why we did not slot this in Tier 1A. However, what we can measure is this. When people have these experiences, they overwhelmingly interpret them as encounters with something larger than themselves, and those encounters reorganize their lives. People who are convinced this world was all there is suddenly experience a radical shift in their perspective. Across multiple datasets, more than half of participants who describe themselves as strongly materialist before the experience change their worldview afterwards, ultimately believing that reality includes something beyond the physical. Now, compare that to conventional religious settings. Only a small percentage of people in a single religious service report an immediate, lasting worldview conversion, which means these psychedelic experiences in controlled settings appear to shift beliefs at rates dramatically higher than ordinary exposure to a religious doctrine. That's incredibly significant. And when you ask people to describe what they experienced, the language becomes familiar. They say it felt more real than real. The same phrase used in near-death experiences, the same phrase echoed in hospice care, not just a dream or hallucination, but hyper-real and meaningful. Now, here's what makes this even more interesting. You don't have to take a psychedelic to see these effects. Setting aside the legal debates and the wait for medical legalization, there's another field in Tier 1B that has exploded over the last two decades, and it bears a remarkable resemblance to what we just saw in psychedelic research, not in altered states, but in regular, ordinary life, and that is the scientific study of spirituality. This line of research didn't begin in a church, it began in a lab. In the 1990s, neuroscientists at major research institutions began asking a simple question. When someone reports a spiritual or transcendent experience, is there anything measurable happening in the brain? Scientists began using SPECT imaging, scans that track blood flow in the brain, to study Franciscan nuns in prayer and Tibetan monks in meditation. Now, they weren't trying to prove God. They were just trying to see whether the experience corresponded to something observable. And it did. During deep prayer and meditation, activity in brain regions tied to spatial orientation and the sense of a separate self decreased. And subjectively, people reported a felt sense of union, not just with people, but with something beyond the physical. Tons of parallels to psychedelics. But that was just the beginning. In the 2000s and 2010s, scientists at Columbia University expanded the question. Instead of asking what happens during a spiritual experience, they asked what happens to people who live with an ongoing spiritual orientation, meaning a lived sense that there is a higher reality, something beyond this. Through longitudinal MRI studies, they found that individuals with a strong sense of connection to something larger than themselves showed measurable differences in brain structure. In particular, thicker cortical regions in areas linked to attention, meaning-making, and emotional regulation. And here's where it becomes clinically significant. In some of their data sets, individuals with a strong personal spirituality were up to 80% less likely to suffer from severe depression compared to those without that orientation. In other words, the same benefits we see in psychedelics research, and for very similar reasons. Spiritual orientation functioned as a buffer, not because of religious labels, but because of an actual inner orientation towards the transcendent. And what began to emerge from this wasn't just spirituality is comforting. It was a theory on the two modes of the brain. One is the default mode most of us live in. Heads down, task-driven, goal-focused, concerned with achievement and control, managing the world directly in front of us. But the second mode activates when attention shifts to the world beyond. And that can happen through things like prayer or nature or meditation. In this theory, spirituality is not a belief. It's a seat of perception. It exists whether you believe in it or not, and it's something you tune into. And when that second mode is activated consistently, the data suggests something changes in your overall well-being. Resilience increases while despair decreases. Now place that next to psychedelics. In controlled settings, psychedelics don't just make people feel connected. They often blast that same perceptual mode wide open, an intensified encounter with what feels like a reality beyond the physical. Now, we need to make an important distinction. Spirituality and religion are not the same thing. For the purposes of this conversation, spirituality can be understood as a genuine, internally chosen perception of connection to something beyond the physical world, a felt orientation towards transcendence. Religion, on the other hand, is a scaffolding, a community project, a shared set of practices, rituals, and beliefs that may help orient someone towards that connection. But religion can also distort it. If someone's experience of religion has been coercive, shaming, or fear-based, that doesn't strengthen the transcendent mode. It can actually interfere with it. In psychology, this is often referred to as religious trauma. And in those cases, religion does not correlate with resilience, but with distress. So the buffering effects we're talking about are not automatic. They're also not guaranteed simply by affiliating with a religion. They appear when the spiritual orientation is genuine, when the connection is internally felt, but not internally imposed. But when religious trauma is absent, and the orientation towards something beyond the self is authentic, the buffering pattern reemerges. So if the neuroscience of spirituality and psychedelic research suggests that we're wired to orient to something beyond ourselves and that doing so improves mental health, then the final field in Tier 1B helps explain why. And that field is the scientific study of happiness. In the early 20th century, psychologists began trying to answer a simple question. What actually makes a human life go well? Not just success or wealth or checking boxes society tells you to check, but a life that feels deeply stable, meaningful, and worth living. In 1938, one of the most important longitudinal studies in history began, what we now call the Harvard Study of Adult Development. And remarkably, it's still running today. For more than 80 years, researchers have tracked the same families, their health, relationships, careers, mental states, across generations. And as the decades pass, more large-scale datasets were added. In 1972, the General Social Survey began collecting national data on American attitudes and behaviors, including life satisfaction and spiritual orientation. And it has continued annually for over 50 years. Then in the late 1990s, Martin Seligman helped formalize what became known as positive psychology, the scientific study of human flourishing. Across these independent streams of research, a pattern began to crystallize. Human flourishing consistently rests on a small set of core elements. First, meaning and purpose. Meaning answers the question, why am I here? Purpose answers, what am I moving towards? Without them, people can achieve outward success and still feel inward emptiness. Second, belonging and love. Decades of data from the Harvard study were ultimately summarized by its director, Robert Waldinger, in one sentence. Good relationships keep us happier and healthier. Love is the bond. Belonging is the context that sustains it. Third, moral coherence. When your internal values align with your external actions, psychological stability increases. When they don't, cognitive dissonance emerges. And that dissonance is one of the primary drivers of anxiety and stress. And finally, transcendence. The consistent finding across decades of research is that humans are most psychologically integrated when they lose themselves in something larger than the individual ego. Now step back and consider, what do psychedelic mystical experiences activate? What does a sustained spiritual life produce? Meaning, love and belonging, oneness and transcendence, moral clarity. The same exact macro components that psychologists have discovered make up happiness. More evidence of our wiring. Now, the immediate response to all this is obvious. You don't need to be spiritual. You don't need faith. You don't need to believe in another world to be happy. And that's true to a point. Plenty of people live meaningful, joyful lives without any spiritual life. But here's what the data suggests. When happiness is built entirely on what we'll call horizontal pillars, relationships, career, status, health, it becomes contingent. As long as those things are stable, life feels stable. But when one of them collapses, your entire structure falls apart. For example, if your primary source of meaning is a relationship and that relationship ends or that person dies, you don't just lose companionship. You lose the foundation of meaning itself. If your identity is anchored entirely in your work and that work disappears, you don't just lose a paycheck. You lose purpose. Now, that's not a moral judgment. It's just fragility that shows up in the data. But spiritual transcendence introduces something different. It's vertical. The source of meaning is not confined to material circumstances. It isn't destroyed by loss or illness or failure. It reframes them. Grief, for example, becomes very different depending on worldview. If this life is all there is and death is the end, then loss carries a really heavy weight. Telling someone who lost their mother they'll never see them again only increases the sense of despair. But if existence continues in some form, grief is still devastating, but it's not the final word. And that's why research consistently shows that individuals with a genuine spiritual orientation, again, genuine, not a mere affiliation, tend to recover from major life shocks more quickly and with less long-term psychological damage. The General Social Survey has repeatedly found that individuals who are actively practicing a faith are significantly more likely to report being very happy compared to those who are unaffiliated. Now, this isn't God magically makes you happy. It's a structural system that gives you access to the macro components of happiness. Faith communities often provide three things at once: a vertical source of meaning, a community that reinforces belonging, and ritual, regular practices that recalibrate perspective. And that combination is difficult to replicate in purely individualistic frameworks. So ultimately, when you zoom out, you have an extraordinary picture that builds on tier 1A. In psychedelics, the depth of the mystical experience predicts long-term improvements in mental health. In neuroscience, a sustained spiritual life strengthens key brain regions and protects against severe depression. And in happiness research, transcendence supplies the core ingredients of flourishing: meaning, belonging, moral coherence, and purpose. Different fields, different methods, same convergence. If Tier 1A suggested that there is something beyond the physical world, Tier 1B suggests we function best when we orient towards it. And that brings us to our final tier, Tier 2. Now, we need to be very clear about what this is and what this isn't. Tier 1A and Tier 1B gave us our strongest lines of evidence, and together they form a structural sketch. Tier 2 is different. These are highly unusual, cross-cultural, experiential evidence. Consistent reports of interaction with something beyond the ordinary physical frame. Some fields are small, some are growing, some are quite frankly strange to talk about, uncomfortable even. And some of them we only find interesting because of how they relate to what we've already seen. They do not carry the same empirical weight as Tier 1. And we're not pretending they do, nor should you. But they are persistent and at times transformative. They are the kinds of experiences that reorganize people's lives altogether. So let's put it this way. If Tier 1A and Tier 1B drew the outline of a puzzle, then Tier 2 may, keyword may, help add some of the puzzle pieces in the middle. It may give clues of how we interact with a larger reality. And this brings us to our first field in Tier 2, spontaneous remission. Spontaneous remission is defined as the partial or complete disappearance of a disease without medical treatment sufficient to explain it. In many of these cases, cancer, autoimmune disorders, advanced diagnoses, the prognosis was grim, which raises an interesting question. Why do some people recover against overwhelming odds? Now, you can't run double-blind trials on spontaneous remission. By definition, it's unpredictable. So researchers have approached it more like investigators, reviewing medical records, interviewing patients, looking for patterns across cases. And over time, a clear pattern does begin to surface. In a surprising number of cases, dramatic recoveries were preceded by a dramatic shift in mindset. Not superficial optimism, but a fundamental reorientation of identity. How the person saw themselves, how they saw their illness, sometimes how they saw reality itself. And that's where mindset research becomes relevant. At Harvard, Dr. Ellen Langer, often referred to as the mother of mindfulness, has spent more than 50 years studying how perception shapes physiological outcomes. Her work has helped ignite an entire field, and what she demonstrated was radical. The lens through which we interpret our circumstances measurably alters how our bodies respond to them. Not metaphorically, biologically. And the clearest example of this is the placebo effect. We tend to dismiss placebo as nothing. It's like a fake pill, a control group, but placebo is not nothing. It is belief activating biology. When someone genuinely believes a treatment will help, measurable changes occur in immune response, pain perception, stress chemistry. This isn't fringe science. It's become one of the most robust findings in medical research. And once that door opened, the field exploded. It became increasingly clear that perception and physiology are not separate systems. Now, extend that logic. Extend that idea even further. If small shifts in belief can change the body, then perhaps a big shift in belief would change it even more. And there's no bigger shift than a spiritual one, because spirituality isn't just adding a belief, it's changing the whole way you see the world. And we've already seen what happens when that kind of shift occurs. Psychedelic studies, more than half of hard materialists report a lasting shift away from a strictly physical worldview after profound mystical experiences. That's not a minor adjustment. That's a complete reorientation. Now, belief isn't just abstract. It actually shows up in the nervous system. And this is where spiritual practices enter the conversation. Prayer, meditation, contemplation. Across traditions, these practices share one physiological effect. They quiet the stress response, they lower cortisol, and they shift the body out of chronic fight or flight. In other words, they function like a biological switch. When someone experiences transcendence, even briefly, the body stops bracing. And when the body stops bracing, healing mechanisms have room to operate. We see the results of this through decades of peer-reviewed studies. Dr. Harold Koenig, one of the most widely cited researchers, has examined this relationship between faith and medical outcomes. Across populations, individuals with a genuine internally lived faith, not merely a religious affiliation, show better health outcomes on average. Now, that doesn't mean belief guarantees healing. Many people who believe don't get any better, but it does mean that belief is not biologically neutral. Orientation is not neutral. And when that orientation includes transcendence, measurable differences appear, which means that a genuine spiritual life not only has a profound effect on our mental health, but also on our physical health. Now, we've said that Tier 2 as a whole does not carry the same empirical weight as Tier 1A and Tier 1B. That's still true. But the science of mindset, the biology of belief, is extensive and well established. What remains more speculative is whether prayer itself produces effects beyond those known psychological pathways. There are thousands of accounts, some medically documented, of people appearing to a higher power and later experiencing measurable recovery. And there have been attempts to study this: intercessory prayer trials, hospital-based studies, controlled experiments. The results are mixed. Some are intriguing, some are controversial, and the research base remains limited. But stepping back, there's a deeper question. If Tier 1A suggested that an interaction across a boundary is possible, is a randomized hospital trial even the right instrument to measure something like prayer? We tend to assume prayer should operate like a transaction. You ask, a force responds, you get the result you wanted. And that's reasonable. But that assumption may also be too mechanical. If there is another layer to reality, it may not operate according to our expectations of linear cause and effect. The mechanism could be more complex, perhaps more relational or contextual, which means the absence of a predictable outcome does not necessarily mean the absence of interaction altogether. Which brings us to our next area of study. Because prayer requests aren't the only place people claim an interaction with something beyond the physical. Across cultures and across centuries, people have reported moments where consciousness itself seems to behave in unusual ways, not by healing or intervention, but through receiving information. And there is a field that has tried, however imperfectly, to study that. Now again, remember, this is Tier 2. We're not in the same category as Tier 1A. These findings are much more controversial, and so we hold it loosely. But the field is precognition. Throughout history, people have reported experiences like premonitions, a sense that something is about to happen before it does, prophecies, specific claims about future events, and what some describe as sudden downloads of information, insights that have a felt sense of being received rather than reasoned, essentially like it's not coming from you. And chances are you've probably experienced a version of this yourself, a strong impression that you were meant to call someone and then something unfolds, a felt sense you were put on the earth to do something specific and a clear vision around it. Now, these experiences are often dismissed as coincidence, and perhaps they are, at least sometimes. But they form the basis of a field that has at least tried to study aspects of this phenomenon. Precognition is the claim that we can, in some way, access information about an event or the future before it happens. At its core, the field is testing two basic assumptions of a strictly material worldview. First, that consciousness is local, meaning confined to the brain and its immediate sensory inputs. Second, that consciousness moves strictly forward through time in a linear fashion. And if either of those assumptions is even slightly wrong, it matters. Not because it proves another dimension on its own, but because it suggests that consciousness may not be operating inside a sealed system. And that's directly relevant to the larger question we've been exploring. The formal scientific study of precognition began in the 1930s at Duke University with J.B. Rhine. Using card guessing experiments known as Zahner cards, Rhine tested whether participants could predict upcoming symbols at rates greater than chance. Across thousands of trials, some subjects scored above statistical expectations. Not dramatically, but consistently enough to reach statistical significance. In the 1970s, interest moved beyond card guessing into what became known as remote viewing. At SRI International, researchers worked on government-funded programs exploring whether individuals could describe distant or future targets. The program, later known publicly as the Stargate Project, ran for years. When it was evaluated in 1995 by the American Institutes for Research, the report acknowledged that statistically significant effects had been observed. At the same time, it concluded that the results were not reliable enough for operational military use. In other words, interesting data, but not definitive. Then in 2011, Ivy League scientist Daryl Bem published a paper in a mainstream psychology journal titled Feeling the Future. And that publication sparked enormous debate. Critics were furious that his research, long considered a pseudoscience, was dignified with a spot in a premier journal. And it sparked a civil war in psychology about research methods. The anger only intensified when several skeptics tried to replicate the study and failed. And yet the story didn't end there. In 2016, BIM and colleagues published a meta-analysis combining results from roughly 90 experiments involving over 12,000 participants. And across those studies, a small but statistically significant effect persisted. Now, it's important to understand what that means. It does not mean people are watching the future like a film. It means that across thousands of trials, responses were slightly tilted above random guessing. Imagine flipping a coin 10 times and getting 6 heads. That's meaningless. But imagine flipping a coin 10,000 times and consistently getting more heads than tails. Not by much, but enough that the probability of it being random becomes very small. And supporters argue the consistency across labs suggests something real is happening. And that's where the field stands today. Not proven or completely dismissed, but contested and statistically interesting. More recently, neuroscientist Julia Mossbridge and others have changed the way the question is being asked. Instead of asking people to consciously predict something, they ask a simpler question. Does the body react before the person knows what's coming? Here's how the experiment works. A participant sits in front of a computer screen. They're told that in a few seconds, an image will appear. The image is chosen randomly by a computer. Sometimes it's neutral, like a chair or a tree. Sometimes it's emotionally intense. And now here's the key. The computer doesn't choose the image until after the participant is already being monitored. Researchers measure heart rate, skin conductance, brain activity, and in some studies, the body appears to shift slightly a few seconds before the emotional image is selected and shown. Not dramatically or in a movie-like way, but statistically across many trials, the body seems to anticipate what hasn't happened yet. The effects are small and the debate ongoing, but across multiple studies and meta-analyses, the signal hasn't disappeared. What's often treated as a sister field to precognition is telepathy. And let's be honest, this is even more controversial. Telepathy is the idea that information can move from one mind to another without any of the usual channels. No speech, no text, no signals we can see. Obviously, this changes our basic assumptions about how communication works. And there have been attempts to study it. One of the most widely known was the Gansfield experiment. In its classic form, one person, the sender, concentrates on an image in one room, while the other person, the receiver, in a separate sensory-reduced environment, describes impressions. Later, the receiver is asked to choose which image matches what they previously perceived. Some of the meta-analyses have reported small but statistically significant effects above chance. But critics push back, citing flaws in technique, subtle cues, or publication bias that explain the results. Most recently, projects like the telepathy tapes have gained public attention, though they've also been criticized for insufficient controls, such as participants being in the room or the potential for unintended signaling. And that's important to acknowledge. The field remains deeply contested. The experimental controls are debated, replication is inconsistent, but we are most interested about this topic not because of the data from the actual field, but because of its connections to the fields discussed in Tier 1A. Across entirely separate domains, telepathy appears again and again as a reported feature. If you remember, in near-death experiences, people frequently describe communication not as spoken language, but as direct transfer of meaning. It appears to be a primary form of communication while people are in that other dimension. And in Dr. John Mack's research on UFO encounters, people also describe similar patterns. Not external sound, but sort of like thought clusters or an immediate understanding that bypassed language. Now, that does not prove telepathy in a laboratory sense, but it does establish something interesting. Different fields, different contexts, the same thing popping up. Direct nonverbal transfer of communication. So the pattern, if nothing else, is this. When consciousness is reported as interacting with something beyond the physical frame, this form of communication repeatedly appears. This is not everyday cognition. It shows up in moments people describe as extraordinary. And few things are as extraordinary, as personal as our next field, after-death communication. Now, this field sounds kooky at first glance, but the connections here are interesting. After-death communication, often shortened to ADC, refers to experiences in which people report sensing, seeing, hearing, or otherwise interacting with someone who has died. This field was brought into focus in the 20th century by researchers like Bill Guggenheim, who began systematically collecting thousands of accounts from individuals who claimed to have experienced contact with deceased loved ones. The reports followed patterns, a vivid dream that felt more real than ordinary dreaming, a sensed presence, a voice, a sound, and in a smaller subset of cases, specific information later claimed to be verified. And that last detail is what caught the attention of researchers already studying near-death experiences. Now, the immediate skeptical response is grief. And that's a reasonable starting point. Grief alters perception. The brain under stress can generate powerful experiences. But these experiences rarely resemble psychosis. They feel purposeful. And the field persists for two reasons. First, prevalence. A 2023 Pew Research survey suggested that nearly half of U.S. adults report some form of after-death communication, whether sensing a presence, dreaming of a deceased loved one, or interpreting meaningful signs. Second, structure. Many of these experiences are described as coherent, emotionally stabilizing, and deeply transformative. In 2024, neuroscientist Tara Swart, who lectures at MIT, stepped into this conversation in a way that surprised many in her field. Rather than dismissing these reports outright, she proposed a hypothesis that humans may possess more perceptual channels than the traditional five senses framework suggests, that what we categorize as intuition or felt presence may reflect additional sensory integration processes the brain is capable of under certain conditions. She has suggested that the brain may have dozens of perceptual pathways, not all consciously recognized, and that some experiences interpreted as after-death communication may involve underexplored aspects of perception. Now, to be clear, that does not prove contact with the deceased. It's just a theory from one scientist. And the research from the field isn't even what we're most compelled by. Like telepathy, it's the connections it has to Tier 1A. In hospice care, loved ones appear before a transition. In near-death experiences, reunion and direct communication are described. And here, in ordinary life, people report contact across the same divide. Different contexts, same thread. This is tier two. It remains speculative, but taken alongside what we've already seen, it no longer feels isolated. So we have one field left in tier two. And to be honest, this last one is so strange that we resisted including it all together. It's just really, really weird. But in the spirit of taking this investigation seriously, we felt we had to. We'll refer to it as non-local memory. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, psychiatrist Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia began documenting cases of young children who claimed to remember past lives. Not vague feelings, but specific names, specific places, specific events. What struck Stevenson was not just the strangest of the claims, but the pattern. The memories tended to emerge between ages 2 and 5, and they often faded by age 7. And in many cases, the children showed behaviors, phobias, or skills consistent with the life they described. Over 4 decades, Stevenson collected more than 3,000 cases across cultures. And after his death, the work continued under researchers like Jim Tucker at the University of Virginia. The backlash was immediate and intense, as you can imagine. The claims challenged deeply held assumptions. And many critics argue that cultural suggestion, parental influence, or selective reporting explain the phenomena. And that skepticism is reasonable. We also have that skepticism. The topic is extraordinary, but the field has not disappeared because in a small subset of cases, children have described details, names, locations, manner of death, that were later claimed to have matched historical individuals unknown to the family. Now, calling these past life memories is sort of an interpretive leap. Reincarnation is one possible explanation, but is not the only one, or even the most plausible. Some researchers sympathetic to the data have cautioned against assuming that identity literally transfers from one body to another. What the raw data suggests is merely that information appears to be accessed beyond the brain. Not necessarily that a soul has migrated. And here's the tension. If Tier 1A suggests that after death, consciousness continues elsewhere, and near-death experiences describe reunion in another realm, then how do we reconcile that with children claiming memories of past lives? How can someone be there in another dimension and also be here in a reincarnated body? This assuming that we all reincarnate. So that contradiction is real, and it's important. I'm sure someone will come up with a theory in the comment section, but at face value, calling these cases reincarnation may be too simplistic. So here we are. We've moved through Tier 1A. tier 1B, tier 2. If this is all new to you, it's a lot. It took 8 years to synthesize it. And based on everything we've examined, here's the model that best accounts for the data. Call it a theory of everything. 9 major conclusions that seem unavoidable if we take the evidence seriously. Starting with the first, the mind and the brain are not the same thing. The brain clearly plays a role in shaping our conscious experience, but the evidence increasingly suggests that consciousness is not produced by the brain, it is filtered through it. Why? Well, because if the physical world were all there is, we run into a spatial awareness problem. The brain does not have sensory access beyond the body. It doesn't have eyes that see through walls. And yet in near-death experiences, veridical perception repeatedly involves people accurately reporting events outside their physical location, beyond their sensory reach. That alone puts pressure on the model that consciousness is strictly confined to neural tissue. And hospice data adds to that pressure. Terminal lucidity documented in patients with advanced Alzheimer's and severe neurological decline shows individuals regaining clarity, memory, and coherent speech just before death. And we can observe the physical deterioration of their brains on MRI scans. And yet, at the threshold of death, consciousness appears intact, sometimes more intact than it has been in years. If consciousness were nothing more than neural firing, that should not happen, and yet it does. Now, we could include non-local memory here. The idea that some children appear to access information they shouldn't normally have. And even if a small fraction of those cases are genuine, then information is not strictly local to the brain. But here's the caveat. Even if that entire field, non-local memory, were somehow overturned tomorrow, the core case does not collapse. Because veridical perception in near-death experiences still presents a spatial problem for a closed material model. Terminal lucidity still presents a neurological problem for a strictly brain-generated consciousness model. Those two alone are sufficient to force the conversation. Non-local memory, if anything, is additive, not foundational. The second conclusion follows naturally. There appears to be a dimension beyond the physical world, and it is structured. And here's how we can determine that. If veridical perception is real, meaning a person accurately reports events outside their body, then spatial awareness has already been breached. At that point, the hallucination explanation collapses, because hallucination assumes the brain is generating internal content. But veridical perception involves external information that the brain could have not accessed through normal sensory channels. So once that boundary has been crossed, it is no longer logically consistent to say that what follows is just a hallucination. You cannot argue that consciousness left the room, gathered accurate information, and then suddenly became delusional the moment it entered the next phase of the experience. That's not a coherent explanation. Not to mention that what follows in near-death experiences is not chaos. It is highly structured and consistent. Across tens of thousands of documented cases spanning more than a century, the same core elements repeatedly appear. And those are only the formally studied cases. Survey data suggests millions worldwide report similar experiences. Different cultures, different belief systems, same structure. The evidence is pushed further when you consider that in a smaller subset of cases, individuals return with information from that structured realm that they couldn't have known otherwise. So veridical perception establishes that consciousness can operate beyond the body. The structured realm describes what happens beyond it, and together they suggest not randomness, but order. Now, in terms of a secondary line of evidence, multiple dimensions are also implied through UFO phenomena. Military recordings and multiple sensor systems have captured objects doing things that shouldn't be possible with the technology we know. They go from still to extremely fast in an instant. They make sharp turns without slowing down. They move from air into water without breaking apart. They appear and disappear. Whatever these things are, they are not behaving like normal aircraft. It's as if they are functioning under a different set of rules, which is why one of the leading theories with scientists is that UFOs are interdimensional. And here's what's interesting. When people report close encounters, they don't just describe strange objects. They describe encounters with otherworldly beings. And that sounds familiar. In near-death experiences, people also describe encounters with non-human intelligences. And lastly, psychedelics are also worth mentioning here. While they don't serve as empirical proof of another dimension, there is something striking about what follows those experiences. Across cultures and belief systems, people who undergo profound mystical states overwhelmingly come to the same conclusion. There is more to life than this dimension. The third conclusion that starts to emerge from the data is this. If there's a dimension beyond ours, it doesn't appear to operate the way this one does. And it may, keyword may, interact with ours in ways that are unusual. Although if those interactions happen, they seem to be rare. Look at near-death experiences. One of the most consistent descriptions is a complete shift in how time behaves. Not past, present, future, but something more like a single unified moment. Events don't unfold one after another, they're experienced all at once. People say time feels irrelevant or collapse. That alone tells you we're not dealing with ordinary perception. Communication shifts too. Over and over again, people describe it not as spoken language, but as direct knowing, meaning transferred instantly. No words, no sound, no delay, just understanding. Researchers in near-death studies have documented this pattern across cultures, across belief systems, across decades. And that's interesting because in completely separate lines of research, like telepathy studies, you see descriptions that sound very similar. Again, we're not saying that field has empirically proven anything on its own because it hasn't. But when independent domains start describing the same mechanics, that's where it gets difficult to ignore. It's the parallels that matter. The fourth conclusion is this. Across the datasets we've examined, people consistently report encountering an intelligent relational presence. In near-death research, this is one of the most common features of the experience. People use different labels, being of light, God, source, the divine, but the underlying description is remarkably consistent. An intelligent presence, personal, relational, an experience as overwhelming love. In Dr. Bruce Grayson's clinical samples, roughly 90% of subjects reported some form of encounter with this presence. Now zoom out, look at the other converging fields. They don't provide the same kind of empirical evidence as near-death studies, but they move in the same direction. In controlled psychedelic research, a large percentage of participants walk away convinced that a higher intelligence exists, and that is defined by unconditional love. Sometimes they use different language to describe that, but the shift is dramatic. And then look at happiness science and the science of spirituality. Across large data sets, when people report a genuine lived connection with the divine, however they define it, their outcomes improve dramatically. Different fields, different methods, same direction. The fifth conclusion is this. Our deceased loved ones appear to persist beyond death. In near-death research, people don't just describe entering a realm or encountering light. They consistently describe reunion, specific, recognizable individuals. Parents, siblings, spouses, friends. And these aren't symbolic figures. They are described as distinct identities with memory, personality, and relationship intact. Now look at hospice care. Weeks before death, patients report seeing people who have already died. In some studies, over 80 to 90% of the figures reported were deceased loved ones. And that matters because if this were simply a hallucination, you would expect a random mix of people, living and dead, anyone the mind has cataloged. But that is not what shows up. The calm, structured encounters overwhelmingly involve people who have already passed. And they seem to be preparing hospice patients for a transition. The pattern is consistent across countries, hospitals, and decades of documentation. Then there is a third field, far more speculative, known as after-death communication. In some cases, individuals report receiving information from deceased loved ones that they later verify independently, information they claim they had no normal way of accessing. This field does not carry tier 1A weight. It remains debated and controversial, but the parallels are striking. Different contexts, same findings. The sixth finding is this. Human beings do not appear to be the only form of intelligence interacting with reality. We mentioned this briefly in conclusion two, but it deserves to stand on its own. And you see it in the UFO data. Whatever these phenomena are, they behave in ways that strongly imply intelligence behind them. Now that alone doesn't tell us what the intelligence is, it doesn't tell us where it comes from, but it does suggest we're not dealing with randomness. And that lines up with near-death experiences. People consistently describe encountering intelligences that are not human. Sometimes they're described as guides, sometimes as observers, sometimes simply as the others. But taken together, it places real pressure on the assumption that human cognition is the only intelligence that exists. The seventh conclusion is this: reality appears to have a moral structure. You see this most clearly in the life review described in near-death experiences. People don't just replay events from their lives, they experience them from their own perspective and from the perspective of the people they affected. They don't just remember what they did, they feel what others felt. And what's striking is that the higher intelligence encountered in these experiences does not appear punitive. It's not described as condemning. It's described as concerned with understanding, with coming to terms with how one's actions impacted others. That pattern shows up again and again. Now, zoom out to happiness science. One of the most stable findings across decades of research is this: when people's internal values align with their external actions, psychological stability increases. And when they don't, dissonance grows. Anxiety increases. We experience distress when we violate what we believe to be right. Now, of course, in the real world, people's moral frameworks differ. And we're not trying to step into a philosophical debate about ultimate ethics here. That's not what this video is about. But what persists across humanity is this: we are structured in such a way that coherence between belief and behavior matters deeply to our well-being. Taken together, the data suggests something important. Our actions are not neutral. They reverberate, and reality in some form appears to respond to that. The eighth conclusion is this: the purpose of life does not appear to be self-indulgence. It appears to be love, specifically self-giving love, connection, belonging, service towards others, and taken together, those form the basis of meaning. You can see this most clearly in the life review. When people describe reliving their lives, the moments that carry weight are not the moments of status, accumulation, or personal pleasure. They are the moments where they helped someone or harmed someone, where they acted with love or failed to. The emphasis is relational. You can also see it in how the higher intelligence is described in near-death accounts. It is described as concerned with how we treated other people, with whether we loved well. And that theme repeats. Zoom out to the science of spirituality and happiness research across decades of data. Flourishing consistently centers around a small set of variables: meaning, belonging, moral coherence, transcendence. And meaning is most reliably generated not through self-focus, but through contribution, through giving, through being a part of something bigger than yourself. Even attachment science in psychology, which we haven't gone into in this episode, reinforces this. Secure attachment, relational safety, mutual care, these are the foundations of psychological stability. Across all these fields, the same pattern emerges. Life appears structured around relationship, and meaning appears to flow most strongly through love expressed outward. And finally, conclusion number 9. Even if you rejected every extraordinary claim in this episode, even if you dismissed near-death experiences, UFO data, hospice care, all of it, one thing would still remain: a genuine spiritual life and believing that all of this does exist is overwhelmingly correlated with better mental and physical health. That's not speculation, that's data. And that alone represents a radical shift from where this conversation stood 100 years ago. When this topic lived almost entirely in the realm of religion, skeptics argued that spirituality and faith were wishful thinking, an illusion, a psychological crutch. But now we know that discouraging someone from a genuine spiritual orientation can actually handicap their well-being. And here's what's most striking. After all the extraordinary things that we've discussed, miracles, telepathy, whatever it might be, the data suggests that the most important dimension of spirituality isn't the spectacular. It's the ordinary. It's how you live day to day, whether you're becoming a person of character, whether you are growing in love, whether you're paying attention to your inner life, whether you're open to guidance, sometimes through conscience, and sometimes through intuition, sometimes through dreams or impressions that don't feel entirely self-generated. Extraordinary experiences may exist, they may matter, but the evidence suggests that what shapes a life is a slow work of love practiced consistently. That is undeniable. So where do we go from here? Almost every major shift in science began as something that sounded strange. Neuroplasticity was dismissed in the 1960s. It was called fringe, speculative, even embarrassing. And today, it's foundational to neuroscience. That pattern has repeated throughout history. Ideas that once felt impossible eventually became obvious. And we are standing at another one of those inflection points. This conversation is no longer about religious faith versus skepticism. It's no longer about whether you believe in another dimension or a higher intelligence. It's about whether our current model of reality is incomplete. If another dimension exists and the data strongly suggests it does, then it exists whether you believe in it or not. Gravity doesn't require belief. Germs don't require belief. Neuroplasticity didn't wait for consensus before it became real. And if consciousness extends beyond the physical frame, if there is another layer of reality interwoven with this one, then it isn't a matter of faith. It's a matter of perception. And that's confronting. It was confronting for us. We've said multiple times how uncomfortable some of these fields were to examine. Adjusting your worldview in light of converging evidence is never easy, whether you're religious or skeptical or somewhere in between. But intellectual honesty demands it. Religion has been criticized for dogma, for clinging to conclusions regardless of evidence. And at times, that criticism has been fair. But scientists can also fall into the same trap. Not because the scientific method is flawed, but because the people practicing it are human. We are trained to be cautious, to ask for proof, to question bold claims. That instinct is not the enemy. It is the spirit of this entire episode. But here's the uncomfortable reality. Sometimes you can have evidence, convergence, decades of independent data, and yet you still reject it, not because it's weak, but because it's disruptive. Because adjusting your model of reality is costly, both for a religious person or a skeptic. And so skeptic can become protection, not protection of truth, but protection of worldview. It's important that we think critically, but we also must apply that evenly. If converging evidence challenges religious dogma, we examine it. If it challenges materialist dogma, we examine that too. The standard must be consistent. Otherwise, it isn't science. Now, there are still enormous unanswered questions. Mechanisms we don't understand. Interpretations that may ultimately belong to philosophy right now as much as science. And what we've presented today is a synthesis. Not a completed theory with every single question answered. We believe all of these fields deserve more funding, more rigorous investigation, more institutional attention, and disagreement will follow. It should. That's how progress works. Serious claims deserve serious critiques. So tell us where you land in the comments. We want to hear from you not as spectators, but as participants in this investigation. And if this model of reality is right, then this conversation needs more minds involved, not fewer. If you'd like to go deeper, we've already conducted long-form episodes with many of the leading researchers in these areas. Those are linked below in the description. But for us, the next step is clear. If this model of reality holds, even partially, then the claims of the major world religions need to be placed side by side with it. Not to dismiss them or reduce them, but to examine carefully where they align with the data, where they diverge, and whether ancient metaphysical language was pointing at the same underlying structure using different vocabulary. That is a massive undertaking, but it is a next logical step. So we've covered a lot today. Data, patterns across disciplines, arguments that challenge the edges of the material model. But sometimes the clearest articulation of something complex doesn't come from analysis. It comes from experience. So we want to leave you with this, an account from someone who had a near-death experience recorded in Dr. Bruce Grayson's book After, because it captures what it looks like when the mind is no longer constrained by the brain, when whatever this world truly is becomes visible. And here's how she described the moment she died. "Suddenly, I felt this pull as if I was no longer being constrained to this world and its limits. Imagine, if you will, a huge dark warehouse. Everything you know about what's contained within this enormous space is what you've seen by the beam of one small flashlight. Whenever you look for something, you may or may not find it, but that doesn't mean the thing doesn't exist. It's there, but you just haven't shown your light on it. And even when you do, the object you see may be difficult to make out. Now imagine that one day someone flicks on a switch. There, for the first time, in a sudden burst of brilliance and sound and color, you see the entire warehouse, and it's nothing like you've ever imagined. You see the colors you don't recognize, ones you've never seen before. The vastness, complexity, depth, and breadth of everything going on around you is almost overwhelming. You can't see all the way to the end of space, and you know there's more than what you can take in from this torrent that's tantalizing your senses and emotions. But you get a strong feeling that you're actually part of a large and unfolding tapestry that goes beyond sight and sound. You understand that what you used to think was your reality was, in fact, hardly a speck within that vast wonder that surrounds you. You can see how all these various parts are interrelated, how they all play off each other, how everything fits. You notice just how many things there are in the warehouse that you never seen, never even dreamed of existing in such splendor and glory of color. But here they are, along with everything you already know. And even the objects you are aware of have entirely new context so that they too seem completely new and strangely super real. Even when the switch goes back on, nothing can take away your understanding and clarity. Nothing can ever cancel your knowledge of all that exists in the warehouse. You're now far more aware of what's there, how to access it, and what's possible than you ever were with your little flashlight.